Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who examines the possible repercussions of the recent rescue of 15 hostages held by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Neil Watkins of the Jubilee USA Network, who critiques policy supported by the Group of Eight Nations meeting in Japan that he believes have exacerbated the rise in food prices, poverty, and global warming. And Tim Castleman, founder of the Drive55.org website, who explains the cost savings, geopolitical, and environmental benefits of mandating a 55-mile-per-hour national speed limit. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the price of oil hovering above $140 a barrel, armed militias in Nigeria's Niger Delta are making oil traders nervous. A mid-June nighttime raid by Nigerian gunmen in speedboats shut down an offshore Shell Oil drilling platform in Nigeria and shook up the oil market. According to the Los Angeles Times, political violence has disrupted the flow of oil in Nigeria, Iraq, and Colombia. Political instability and violence have also hampered oil production in Venezuela, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. Although the militias in the Niger Delta have long-running grievances against the Nigerian military and oil giants like Shell and Chevron, the groups have been accused of stealing oil and selling illicit weapons in the region. Since 2005, attacks have cut Nigerian oil production 20% to 30%. The Bush administration has pushed for a political settlement between the Nigerian government and the militias and taken steps to beef up the Nigerian Navy. But peace talks have stalled. When the Democrats took control over Congress in 2007, the U.S. pharmaceutical industry, the nation's largest lobby, boosted its spending by 32% to $168 million, according to a new study by the Center for Public Integrity. Big pharma and medical device companies, who spend an additional $20 million on lobbying, were worried about the actions of industry critics like Los Angeles Congressman Henry Waxman, who chaired oversight hearings on drug safety, pharmaceutical pricing, and the availability of generic medicines. For the first time in years, drug makers and medical device companies gave more money to Democrats than Republicans. During the 2006 election, the drug industry favored Republicans in its political contributions by a 2-to-1 margin. Much of the industry lobbying was defensive, working to block new initiatives like importation of cheaper drugs from other countries and increasing the market access of U.S. pharmaceutical companies in global free trade agreements. Big Pharma sided with Democrats in pushing for the expansion of the state child health insurance program, which President Bush vetoed. Analysts say the industry would benefit from increased funding for SCHIP by expanding their sales of medicines for children. In 1992, 27 women were elected to the U.S. Congress. While the ranks of women have slowly increased in the U.S. House, Senate, and among governors since the 1990s, they are still below the 25% mark for all major elected offices in the United States. So far this year, only two women have won primary races for governor, in contrast to the 11 women who won statewide primaries for governor in 1994. Gender has become a major issue on the campaign trail in 2008, focused mostly on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Top Clinton supporters blamed sexism, especially on cable talk shows, for the failure of Clinton's historic campaign. Yet there is no surge of new women candidates seeking political office this year. According to the American Prospect magazine, women legislators are more likely to push for liberal issues and three times more likely to belong to the Congressional Progressive Caucus. In 2007, Nancy Pelosi was the first woman to be elected Speaker of the House and became a leading voice in the Democratic Party. Activists see this as an individual success story and not the result of a major political push by feminist groups. The glass ceiling in politics, it seems, has only been cracked, not shattered. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A group of 15 hostages held by the leftist guerrilla group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, were rescued by the Colombian military on July 2nd in what they described as an elaborate hoax on the rebels. Among the hostages freed were three U.S. Pentagon contractors captured in 2003, Ingrid Betancourt, a French-Colombian politician and one-time presidential candidate held for 6 years, and 11 Colombian soldiers and police. The military, with the assistance from the U.S., says it succeeded in the rescue operation by infiltrating the highest ranks of the FARC command and tricking rebels, holding the hostages into believing that the group's leadership had arranged for the relocation of the captives. Swiss news reports maintained that the guerrillas had been paid $20 million in ransom money, a claim denied by the Colombian government. The FARC, founded in 1964 and estimated to have 10,000 fighters, has funded its operations in part by capturing soldiers, politicians, and civilians and later releasing them for ransom or in exchange for the freeing of FARC prisoners. The group continues to hold hundreds of captives. The guerrilla group has suffered major setbacks in recent months, with two of its top commanders being killed and FARC founder Manuel Marulanda dying of a heart attack in March. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who examines the possible repercussions in the aftermath of the hostage rescue and the prospects for future peace talks between FARC and the government of Colombian President Álvaro Uribe.
What we have here is a pattern, and the pattern is that the original versions, like, for example, the March 1st attack on the Colombian encampment inside Ecuador, in which 25 people were killed, including Raul Reyes, the second in command of FARC. That started off as a rather small story, that is, a Colombian attack. It was a very surgical kind of thing. But it turned out to be much more involved, many more actors, and not exactly as glorious as it sounded. At the time, we brought out an analysis saying that we thought we knew the Colombian army. We had studied the Colombian army. We were aware of its tendencies and capabilities. And the Colombian army was not a particularly coherent fighting force, even though it had improved in the past several years as a result of U.S. trainers. There are 700 or 800 allowed to be in the country at any one time. And, of course, the country has received since the year 2000 over $5 billion worth of military aid. The military has certainly been improved. But it's not too long ago that not one but two Colombian generals said that the military does not have the capacity to defeat the FARC in an all-out war, and that negotiations were required. Well, all of a sudden, we have these extraordinary missions being performed, utilizing very sophisticated equipment, and the story begins, this was an old Colombia product. Then it morphs into being something else, that the United States has given significant consultation and intelligence assets, where the phrase is used, and that tracking equipment had been provided. Now, I would imagine that it's an entirely different kind of story if they really pulled this off, or they got one guy who was located in the encampment who worked for the FARC, and who was paid a good deal of money to help arrange this whole thing, or to disclose information to the Colombian authorities where certain people would be at a certain time. That is one possible scenario. Another scenario is that the whole thing was stage managed by FARC in order to generate some revenue. FARC is fiscally hurting right now. It normally operates on an annual budget of between $60 million and $200 million a year, and it's been so distracted in recent months that nothing like that kind of money has been generated by its normal activities.
Larry, I've read a story that with this recent release of hostages, that the Colombian government may engage in direct negotiations with FARC, whereas before they had been going through European intermediaries. Do you have any sense of where that might go?
Uribe has always wanted to directly negotiate with FARC, and he is again announcing this. He acted in an extremely whimsical fashion several weeks ago when he first entrusted negotiation with the FARC over the issue of the release of political hostages like Bentancur with Hugo Chavez. And then he summarily fires Chavez just because Chavez, in a careless moment, picked up the phone and spoke to the commander of the Colombian army on matters pertaining to his attempt to get these hostages released. I mean, everyone was amazed that Uribe so capriciously would dismiss Chavez from a function that was essential for Colombia's and Chavez's goodwill.
And Chavez, from what I understand, was on the brink of making a deal for the release of those hostages. And with what you just described, Uribe called it off, and there was a lot of upset on the part of families of the hostages.
Yeah, what we have now is a whole series of rather interesting things happening. Chavez and Fidel Castro have both, and the president of Ecuador, Correa, these are important friends of the FARC, or those who think well of the FARC. They all said that a guerrilla force should have no business in abducting people, and that all hostages should be immediately released. Now, Fidel stepped aside a bit by saying that the FARC shouldn't lay down their arms. The reason why he said that is very apparent. That is, in the 80s, a faction of the FARC called Popular Union demobilized, returned to political life in the country, and formed a political party to contest the election. Not one, but two of their presidential candidates were assassinated. And I believe, if my memory is right, almost every legislative candidate that the UP put up was murdered.
That was Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact the council at area code 202-223-4975 or visit their website at COHA.org. As the leaders of the world's wealthiest nations meet in Hokkaido, Japan, for the Group of Eight or G8 summit, thousands of protesters were in the streets to voice their opposition to the powerful nation's policies on skyrocketing food prices, poverty reduction, and global warming. The farmers, trade unionists, and students who gathered in Hokkaido to demonstrate were confronted by massive security and more than 20,000 police. In recent years, opponents of corporate-led globalization and free trade policies have staged large and sometimes militant protests to call attention to the links they see between G8 policies favoring the rich and rising global inequality, as well as damage to the environment. Addressing some of these concerns, G8 leaders have in the past pledged to increase their aid to the impoverished majority in Africa, but have yet to fulfill that promise. This year, the G8 endorsed the idea of cutting greenhouse gas emissions 50% by the year 2050. But some environmentalists criticized the announcement, saying that goals were weak and avoided specific emission reduction targets. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Neil Watkins, national coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network, which advocates debt forgiveness for the world's poorest nations. He critiques some International Monetary Fund and World Bank policies supported by the G8 that he believes have exacerbated the rise in food prices, poverty, and global warming.
Well, the G8 meet every year to talk about issues of global concern, and this year they're actually talking about some of the right issues, but the problem is that the solutions that have been offered and some of the promises that haven't been kept are really what's that issue? So you have on the agenda of the G8 summit this year in Japan issues like the importance of aid in Africa, issues of climate change, that, you know, they're discussing the impact of the food crisis and the rising price of food and fuel all across the global south. But, you know, in terms of what's actually happening, what the policies are coming out, you see a lot of these protests that you mentioned because the responses from the G8 have definitely not been sufficient. Just on one issue, in 2005, the G8 met in the UK in Glen Eagles, and they promised $50 billion in aid that they would provide by the year 2010. And there have been a slew of reports that basically show that the G8 is about $30 billion behind in meeting that pledge. Even when the G8 does something good, as it did in 2005, they're not keeping their promises, which is, you know, especially devastating because right now things are getting worse in many countries across the globe with the food crisis and the rising price of oil hitting really hard.
Neil, you have written about some of the connections between structural adjustment policies pushed by the IMF and World Bank on some of the poorer nations of the world, and the price of food, the debt crisis, and climate change. You want to expand on that a little bit for our audience?
You know, it's interesting because now you have the food crisis in much of the global south, but if you look back at some of the policies that put some of the world's poorest countries into the global economy and sort of forced them into this globalized world of food production, you see that played at least an important role in the crisis you have today. So some of the policies were basically through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. You know, G8 nations have encouraged countries to remove subsidies on basic food for their people or privatize efforts that were in place at a state level to help farmers get access to credit. So, you know, what that did is it, in essence, made it more difficult for countries to have food self-sufficiency or food security. And, you know, it made them more dependent on sort of these global food markets. And now you see the result of that, which is that as prices go up around the world, prices are going up in poor countries and making it really impossible for people to eat. And, you know, in a country, for example, like Haiti, not far from us here in the United States, you know, there are widespread reports that because of the food crisis there, people are eating dirt cakes. You know, basically, you know, it's a type of cake, but it's made largely of dirt and some food, but that's the only way they can get enough nutrients and calories just to be able to survive. So it's a pretty desperate situation. And you know, one of the issues we've raised is that even the responses that are being proposed, certainly I think, you know, the G8 leaders are aware of these issues and have an intent to try to address some of these problems, but the responses so far have been, rather than new grants or expanded debt cancellation for countries, it's been a failure to meet promises that they already made, and it's been proposing to make new loans to poor countries and saying, you know, we'll help you respond to the food crisis by offering you new loans. And I think if you look at, you know, the way countries have been indebted over the years, that's not the best way, because countries will just get right back into debt.
Neil, tell us a little bit about the connections that you see between some of the economic development policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the problem of global warming, climate change.
First of all, if you look at, you know, the causes of climate change today, you know, the first thing you notice is that the eight leaders sitting around the table at the G8 summit, those nations those leaders represent, including our own, are the largest contributors to climate change by far. So if you look at this from a development point of view, climate change is not just affecting the G8 countries. It's affecting countries all across the world. But in a sense, you know, we as G8 nations, I think, owe a climate debt to much of the developing world in that it is our factories, it has been our cars that have been the largest determinant of climate change. Then we're now trying to put pressure on our government to actually respond to that and to take action to at least slow the emissions so that we can, you know, survive really in this world. One of the big issues, though, is that poor countries need money now to start adapting to climate change. So climate change is already beginning. They need to be able to adapt to the effects which have already begun to emerge, desertification, rising waters, these sorts of things, droughts, floods. Poor countries need assistance. And so far, what we've been hearing is, even though, you know, the G8 had this key role in promoting climate change, the response is, well, we'll give you, again, more loans to help deal with the climate crisis. And we think that's the wrong way to go. We think that adaptation to climate change for poor countries should come in the form of grants, that we ought to recognize our debt, in essence, to the rest of the world and provide assistance in a way that helps the rest of the world deal with kind of the mess that we largely created.
That was Neil Watkins, National Coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network. Contact the group by calling area code 202-783-3566 or visit their website at jubileeusa.org. On the day before the Independence Day holiday, Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia, floated the idea of returning to a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit on American highways. Warner wanted to know if the Bush administration might support efforts in Congress to mandate a lower speed limit. In 1974, Congress set the national speed limit at 55 due to energy shortages triggered by an Arab oil embargo. The speed limit was repealed in 1995 when crude oil prices dropped to $17 a barrel and a gallon of gasoline cost $1.10. Warner cited government studies in 1975, which concluded that the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit saved 167,000 barrels of oil a day, or 2% of the country's highway fuel consumption, while preventing up to 4,000 traffic deaths a year. Senator Warner speculated that given the much greater number of vehicles on the road today and the large increase in vehicle miles driven, the fuel savings would be much higher in 2008. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tim Castleman, a retired heating and air conditioning contractor and current part-time web designer, who started a website called Drive55.org to promote the benefits of lowering the speed limit in economic savings, geopolitical stability, and lowering the output of greenhouse gases that cause global warming. He's posted to his website the comments of several politicians, mostly at the state level, who endorse the call to drive slower to save money, reduce dependency on foreign oil, and improve traffic safety. But he says, so far, they're the exception.
Politicians don't want to talk about it because there's kind of a double-barreled whammy there. For starters, it's very unpopular. People really have a need for speed, especially the NASCAR Nation type. And then the straw that breaks the camel's back is that politicians depend on revenue from consumption. Not only gasoline sales and the tax that is 18 cents federal and the rest state, so a total of about 50 cents a gallon revenues, but also taxes on tires and brakes and car sales and all the related bit.
I remember in the 70s when the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was put into place, it didn't seem to engender a lot of opposition. People just did it. Do you think this is a case now where the politicians are out of sync with the public? Or the public really doesn't want to drive slower, to lower the speed limit to 55?
When you look at how much money they can save, all right, let's take that by itself. Let's say it's $1,000 a year, which is a significant sum. Still, that works out to less than $100 a month. And if you divide that up by 4 weeks, that's $25 a week, less than maybe $20 a week. And if you ask the typical man on the street, would you mind spending an extra $20 a week to drive as fast as you want? Well, the answer's obvious. People don't care that much. The cost savings alone hasn't been enough, even at $5 a gallon, to get people to be willing to slow down. They'll maybe cut down on trips or whatever, but to slow down, they've become so addicted to the speed and the whole culture of speed that it's going to be very difficult to dislodge that from people without some pain. Now, back in the 70s, we had odd-even days where every other day you couldn't buy gas unless you had the right kind of license plate. There were lines at the gas station. It was obvious what was going on. What's happened here in this current so-called energy crisis, there's no lines. There's no gas rationing. None of this is happening. We had an opportunity right after 9/11. George Bush, instead of coming out and saying, hey, everybody get back on airplanes, go back to the mall, George Bush could have said, America, we need to tighten our belts. We're headed for some tough times. And he didn't.
Tim Castleman, you have a lot of bumper stickers available on your website that say things like Drive 55 for our children, for peace, for polar bears, for our troops, one that just has the number 55 in a circle.
Bumper stickers emerged as really initially a more of a defensive measure to kind of let other people know, hey, look, we're chilling here. Easy does it. Go around me. And then we found out, I began to learn that when you put a bumper sticker on your car, it automatically makes you want to kind of, you know, well, not be a hypocrite. And so it serves a kind of a threefold purpose to help people, you know, moderate their own behavior, to communicate the message to other drivers, and to spread the message.
What about environmental concerns? Driving 55 not only saves money and reduces the need for foreign oil, of course, but there are huge concerns with global warming, and the transportation sector is such a huge contributor to that.
This is really important. You see, it's not a flat line of savings. It's the faster you go, the more you waste. The peak efficiency achieved is right around between 35 and 45 miles an hour. After that, everything after that, it drops off. For every 5 miles per hour, you lose a percentage, 5 or 10% of efficiency. And it just keeps climbing as you go faster. So by simply observing all speed limits, never exceeding 55 miles an hour, you're going to not only change lead in your right foot into gold in your pocket, you're also going to reduce your climate change emissions by up to 50%.
This is something you believe in, and you started it on your own, and you said your website is getting more traffic now. Is this something that you hope will generate some kind of grassroots momentum, that the politicians will feel they have cover to do something about lowering the speed limit?
You know, I think that's even actually what is happening right as we speak. The first uptick in interest came when gas hit $3 a gallon. When it hit $4 a gallon, it was even more intense. And now there's been sort of a sustained interest ever since it was hit $4. And now there's finally some politicians kind of coming on board. And then once politicians get an idea that, yeah, you know, that people want this, that people would support this, you know, the people lead, the politicians will follow.
That was Tim Castleman, founder of the website drive55.org. Contact Castleman at area code 916-489-8601. Or visit his site for additional information and to read the daily posting of the cost of gasoline in all 50 states. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at vtlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.